record.
All right. This is Roger Eardley Pryor. I'm here with Tyke James for another of our interviews with the Imagining Philadelphia's Energy Futures Project. And we are at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Today is August 2nd, 2017. Tyke, would you mind spelling your name for me?
Yes. T-Y-K-E-E and then J-A-M-E-S.
All right. And Tyke, where were you born?
I was born in North Philadelphia.
When were you born?
The 21st day of the 194th year. Well, wait, 1994, January 21st.
Nice, Jan 24. All right.
21st,
yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And you said North Philly?
Mm-hmm.
Where in North Philly?
It was just off of 9th and Diamond. I was born at Temple Hospital.
Oh, cool.
It was a Friday. I remember it fondly.
You remember it well. A beautiful day.
Yeah, it was a great winter day.
Awesome. So how would you describe yourself to meeting somebody that hasn't met you?
Charismatic. The first thing I would say is probably charismatic, and if I'm eccentric, it's because it's probably on purpose. I'm an undercover strategic thinker, but, you know, I like having some fun with words.
Cool. Is your family from Philadelphia as well?
Yes. My dad went to Northeast, and I believe my mom went to Albany.
What are your parents' names?
Jewel Felder James is my mother, and Winnell Edward James is my father. I believe his middle name is Edward.
Winnell.
Yeah. W-N-O-N-E-L.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how they met. How did you come into this world, and what's their story that helped before you arrived?
Well, I'm one of three. I'm second born... Or after the first two. Oh, yeah, I'm second born from him. My oldest brother comes from a different dad. We love each other all the same.
Yeah.
Second from him, and, you know, I have one younger brother. The story goes that they met because somebody must have did something rude to my mother, and my father spoke up and beat him up.
A chivalrous introduction to each other.
That's the story that I was told, and I always roll my eyes, because I don't know if it's true or not. But that really started the relationship. Him showing a humbling amount of courage, whether it be hilarious, and then her, you know, in some ways conceding to his humanity, just to start a basis of a relationship in North Philly.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Nice. Have they lived in Philly their whole lives? Are they from Philly?
Yes. Yeah. They were born and raised both in Philly and... when they got married and had four kids together, then we moved to California. My dad was in the military.
When was that? How old were you?
I was alive.
You were a baby, though.
Yeah, I was a baby. So I may not directly remember getting on a plane to go to California as much as I remember after California getting on a plane to go to Wisconsin.
Huh. Well, how long were you all... Where in California were you?
Military base, Fort Irwin.
Fort Irwin. I don't know where that is.
It's out in the middle of the desert. When I say California, everyone always thinks L.A., but really, as I'm understanding at this age, it was a spot that they used weapons and practice and had different tactics in case they were to ever go to a part of the world that was similar in having desert-like storms present.
Right, yeah. Right.
So it was interesting that that's where I was during that time in the early 90s, mid-90s, leading up to 2000, is when I think my parents divorced. And then when they divorced, I moved to Wisconsin.
Okay.
Lived there for 9 years.
Where in Wisconsin?
Racine.
Okay.
262.
So your parents separated in 2000, and that's around the time when you all moved to...
Or I feel like it was 2000 or 1999. Mm-hmm. Between one of those two dates, I don't necessarily remember who I spent New Year's with or when how my birthday was spent, because normally those two are, like, coincided.
Right.
Like, whatever happened for New Year's, a couple weeks later is my birthday. So where was I during those times? I don't exactly remember, but when I came to Wisconsin, it was cold.
Yeah.
I know that for sure. And I don't know if it was cold because I was relatively warm living in California. A lot of
Wisconsin's straight up cold.
Yeah, or is it just like that's
winter?
Just a brutal, brutal welcome.
Yeah. Well, tell me about, so you spent a good 6 years of young childhood living in California in the desert there with your family.
Yeah.
What are some of your memories of being a young child?
Well, we lived on a military base, so everybody's house looked the same. Everybody went to the same school, and everybody was from somewhere else. I could tell that we all weren't born here. I can immediately, you know, everyone kind of knew that. And my friends were, you know, diverse in complexion and diverse in nationality, or not, ethnicity, I'll say. We would always try to find ways to be different. Like, I would see that my mom would arrange the pebbles in front of our house in a star or a circle so that, like, you know, there's a uniqueness to our house, something that we can recognize on our way home from school. We would play in a park that was, you know, like regular old park.
I'm having a hard time picturing it. So the desert, kind of picturing like the Mojave.
Okay. Imagine there's a utopia, I guess, because none of the grass was actually real,
but they basically plopped,
you know, a livable something, like a place that for about maybe 2 miles people wouldn't complain about. You know, nice houses, one floor. I think it was adobe style, or that's a style, adobo. And let me think, I'm trying to really remember here. Each car had a driveway. Each, you know, member of the house was probably a member of the military. And, you know, everybody's kids would want to play together because it's just like the wives would really be at home all day. I realized after the fact, you know, I learned that, like, oh, you just really, like, stayed at home, did things, and then, like, dad would go to work and, like, the earth would shake and... That wasn't an earthquake. That was them dropping a bomb or something.
Wow. You remember that as a kid?
Like, we would just be chilling, you know, eating dinner, and then, like, everything would just shake, and mom would be like, oh, that's just dad at work. Don't worry about it.
Wow.
And we'd be like, oh, okay. And, like, we would buy things in bulk. Like, I remember 20 boxes of Kellogg's Frosted Flakes.
Why?
Because, like, I guess the military store, that's how they sold it. And also, it's probably convenient, because the military store isn't like Walmart, or it's not like... You know, a Target where you walk in, there's all these different options. It's just like, you get that or that or that. A, B, or C. Buy it all now because you don't want to go back here. It's not like, you know, like I'm saying, it's not like Walmart. I mean, I don't have a lot of memories being there or the customer service, but I would just imagine it wasn't really spruced up. Or you wouldn't have the same expectations of the military shopping place as you would Walmart.
Boy, you mentioned a park that you would play in.
Yeah, it was... We were one of the closest houses to the park, so we would frequent, you know, go to park and, you know, take pictures and stand on things. You know, like what you do as a little person.
Yeah.
You don't have that much. You can't move that fast. You can't climb on things all that well. So most of what we would do is, like, me and my little brother, we would do things and, like, she would just take pictures. Like, oh, okay, that's good. Let's call it in.
How much age difference is there between the four of y'all?
Kyle, the oldest, he is 24 now. No, he's 25, because then Winnell, my immediate oldest, he's 24, I'm 23, and my youngest brother, Marquise, he's 20, turning 21 in October.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, it was...
Pretty close in age there.
My brother and Winnell and I, we were closer even that. We're only 10 months apart. So when it's my birthday, we're both the same age for about a month. And we're not twins, you know, officially.
Yeah.
But we always, when we were old enough to do the math, we figured out how bad that was. Or not bad, maybe weird.
Yeah.
We're like, wow, really?
It happened quick.
Like, I feel like, you know, for the people that knew my mom, they're like, you're pregnant all the time. Like, that's how, I feel like that was their impression. Like, you were pregnant 24/7, 365.
So your brothers are all pretty similar age. Is that mostly who you play with?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I mean, I wasn't the one that liked playing tag and running around a whole lot. I was the one that would be like, huh, look at that.
Huh.
Let's investigate. What is this about? I have questions. You know, I have questions that have answers that, you know, my parents can't necessarily satisfy. So maybe I'll look at that and then I'll try to find that in a book.
Really?
Yeah.
Even as a young age, wanting to research this kind of thing.
Yeah. I was like, huh, my parents are not the leading authority on all information. They definitely know things, but they don't know everything. So maybe I should consult a different source. And then that's when it started with, like, the whole idea of science.
Really? For you?
Because I would look at the stars, and I'd be like, what are these? How'd they get there? What do they mean? You know, and living in the middle of the desert in California, one of the beautiful night skies you can see. I remember when my mom said, oh, it's not an earthquake. What's an earthquake? You know, like, so when I thought the earth quakes when, you know, dad's at work. So, like, I don't really understand, you know, how does lightning and thunder happen? Like, there were so many questions that were fundamentally part of, like, my life, part of my day, that I would want answers for. I mean, maybe not so fundamentally or not so persistently, but still, it was like, that exists as a question. And I can recognize that there's a unsatisfied response that I have for that right now.
Mm.
And I would hope to relieve that.
Yeah, even as a young dude. So when y'all, when your parents separated, did all of your family members come to Racine?
Yeah.
Why did y'all go to Racine?
My mom had a sister there.
Okay.
Yeah, my auntie, I guess.
Yeah. Was that aunt originally from Philly?
Yeah.
So what brought her to Racine?
I think her husband, my uncle, but I'm not sure because my auntie and that uncle were both in the Navy, so they did a lot of moving around themselves. My cousins were born in Hawaii, I believe.
Wow.
Because they just moved around so much. Mm. But they also lived in Philly. So I don't know what really brought them to Racine, if it was like, you know, they were both retired, I believe, at the time. They definitely weren't active duty or anything. Because, you know, hanging out with them as a young age, nothing would make me think that they're in the military like my dad. My dad would wear camo, you know, you obviously his boots around and all that. And with them, yeah, they just wore regular clothes, basically had regular jobs, and I was just like, okay.
Huh.
And, like, I would see a picture, you know, of like them with the red, white, and blue and, like, in their uniform. But, like, I didn't make the connection that, oh, yeah, you did that. You know, I was just like, oh. This is regular. This is regular life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's just what it is when you're a kid.
Like, you know, not a lot of that, you know, investigating besides the scientific investigations, I guess, for me.
So you moved there. You were about 6 or 7, somewhere in there. And that's around the time you're starting to really get into some schooling. So what was school like in Wisconsin for you?
I went to Wind Point Elementary School. And that's when I met my first best friend, Xavier Griffin. His birthday is Cinco de Mayo. There, I lived at Shelbourne Court, unit number 103, and then unit number 75, I believe. I've moved twice in that.
How long did y'all live there?
We lived there for 9 years.
Okay.
Yeah, we lived there for a while.
Till about 2009?
Yeah.
And that's when y'all moved back to Philly?
That's when we moved to Texas.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
So 2009. So let's go back 2009 to Texas. Let's stick in Wisconsin for a bit. That seems like a rich time period.
Yeah.
So
what I thought was really fond about Racine was Main Street, Piggly Wiggly, and the fact that the YMCA was right next to the library, which was right near the beach. Now it's Wisconsin, so it's not like California Beach where the water's warm or anything like that, but it was still scenic. It was still nice, and the space had a lot of opportunity for thought, and I definitely appreciated that.
In what way? Tell me, what do you mean by I had opportunity for thought?
I feel like I could just, I mean, not that I had my own agenda at the time, but I feel like I could just walk around and just think, and it wasn't like there was a interference with that. There wasn't a lot of external factors that would negatively affect anything I would think about or anything that I would want to do. It would just be like, as long as I don't mess up in school, I'm good. I can go to the library. My mom was in college at the time, so she would go to the library, and sometimes I would go with her. She would pick up a book, you know, study, and then I would just, like, you know, pick up a book, and I would just read next to her or something.
Huh.
And then there at the library is where I would figure out a lot of answers to things.
Really?
Yeah, because I'd be like, oh, book on storms. I don't know that much about this. Let's see where this takes me. I have no skill to look at the pictures, but I would eventually get to the more profound things, like lightning is very hot. Lightning, like the air around lightning is 20 times hotter than the sun. How is that possible? How hot is the sun? And then I go to an astronomy book, and I'm like, well, look at this. It's a solar system. Everything is so big. Why is everything so big? How did the planets form? What is the Earth made of? And then geology book would come next. And, like, more questions would come and more books would come.
You know? How did your mom respond to this inquisitiveness, this little boy that has all these questions for her?
She was like, she always thought that I would be the perfect college kid. Because, I mean, she, at the time in college, had that same thirst. And, you know, she was studying art and really was heavily involved with art history. When, you know, even in the discipline of art, And I think in the same way, she would see, okay, well, this is a very interesting way that this was arranged. This is signature. This is a motif to this certain artist. This artist at the time, you know, was actually different from the rest of this period for this reason. And, you know, she would really look at the history of decisions in art and, you know, look at sometimes even a more broad sense. Well, this was the tone at the time, and she was interested in that. I never could wrap my mind around it.
Huh.
It was really impressive.
That's really cool.
Most definitely.
So, was the separation also, I mean, you're there, I assume your dad's either stayed in California or was sent
elsewhere.
Yeah,
he stayed in California, I believe. He did come back into our lives a few times.
Yeah.
So, like, it would be like an episodic kind of thing, like, oh, dad's back, and nope, not anymore. They hate each other, so it was like in between them realizing it's good for the kids to stay together versus, no, I can't live with you, you know, and there was, at a time, some visitation, you know, trialed out, where it's just like, you guys visit your dad every other weekend, you guys hang out with him, see what he's up to.
What was that like?
It was more boring there, because, like, I didn't feel as inquisitive. I didn't feel it's free to do anything. He would just sit us all in a room and we'd watch TV, and I'd be like, well, this is the least interesting thing we could do. Every now and then we would go to the park, which I would really enjoy. Every now and then, you know, we would fly a kite, and we're in Wisconsin, I don't know why, but flying a kite is just the thing. Like, it's like, it's the bee's knees, man. Different kites and all that.
Wisconsin
and also, as a kid, like, it's just amazing just to watch a piece of paper fly, you know. It doesn't make any sense. You don't learn about drag and lift until physics.
Wisconsin has a really rich history in America's environmental history.
I mean, oh, yeah.
John Muir spent his childhood there, and a number of writers have come out of there that have done a lot for thinking about human and environment relationships. I'm wondering, as a kid there, would you guys go exploring in the woods? Was this kind of was there a nature experience that you had there, or was it more confined to the city world, the city of Racine?
I would say it was mostly in Racine, because we would walk every day to Gerstad Averholm Middle School, home of the Jaguars. And although we couldn't see a lot of trees and mountains, the environment was also, for us, climate. Because there would be weeks that we could look at the weekly forecast. The high would be 9 degrees. The low would be -2, you know? And the rule is, if it's -11... they have to close schools. So, like, if it's -10, -9, we're walking to school still.
Wow.
Yeah, so it definitely made me tough to cold weather. Because I was just like, this is fine. This is what it is. But every now and then things would get sort of strange. It was just like, why is it 50 degrees on Christmas? You know, why can we go out grilling on my birthday? You know, like, this is sort of strange things that I'm recognizing as, like, I understand that climate, you know, the climate of this place is like this. I mean, there's a Wisconsin geography class that I took when, you know, in elementary school, and there was a lot of understanding of how the lake affects the weather. So there was a huge, you know, talk about, I guess, a communal understanding in Racine about how Lake Michigan affects, you know, the wind, affects cold wind mostly, and brings rain. That was, I think, at the time, what a lot of people understood and what I would gather, I guess.
You mentioned in California at the this kind of implanted suburb in the middle of the desert that y'all lived
in. Really implanted. That's a really good place.
But there was a good bit of diversity and ethnicity in the families and people you were hanging out with. What was this experience like in Racine? Were there other black families aside from your aunt?
Well, we lived with the aunt for a little while until my mom found it. Wow, how is that possible? Until my mom found a place on her own. And where we lived was Shelbourne. Like, that's when, you know, she had her own place. And that place was, what I know for a fact, was a mostly minority community. And, you know, it's reasonable, it was affordable. But even then, I saw that I would select friends that didn't necessarily look like me or sound like me. Or came from the same place. I mean, no one came from the same place.
Part of that inquisitiveness about who you're being with, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, well, where are you from? How are you different? That's unique, and let's celebrate that. I had a friend named AJ who loved drinking milk. That was like his thing. born and bred in Wisconsin.
He's a dairy man through and through.
Yeah, yeah, right? Like, he is the man of Mr. Wisconsin himself. Nashawn Hamilton. He was very nice. He taught me how to do backflips. Yeah, I mean, I was the tallest of the group, so I was, like, least likely to do it, but I did it a few times. We had Chris Arville. I forgot how to pronounce his last name, but his sister's name is Jordan, and the first time I met her, he was like, all right, my sister's name is Jordan. I know it's a guy's name, but don't make fun of her. And I was like, no, man, that's cool. And, like, I was immediately the one to be like, that's fine. And everyone else was like, ha ha. I was like, anyway. Yeah. You know, like, at a young age, I understood, like, I'm not going to say I understood, but I had at least a grasp on names aren't gender binary. Mm. You know, like, it's not like a girl name, guy name. It's a name that you could give a girl. It's a name that you could give a guy, but you don't have to. Mm.
Speaking of names, actually, the name Taiki is so unique. Where's that? What's the story behind that?
I was told, you know, my dad. Imagine it's like Congress, or you know, House and the Senate. So the dad's the House, mom's the Senate. From the House, he first introduced Tai Chi, spelled exactly how you think it would be spelled, Tai Chi. I was shot down. It was like, don't call anybody Tai Chi. That's setting them up for failure. We are a black family, and that's just. You know, you're asking for problems that he's not going to be able to handle when he's a little older. Mm. And he first was like, okay, well, then let's change it to Taiki, but spell it T-I-K-I. She shot that down, too, because she was like, that's Tiki. No matter how you want to read it, that's Tiki. That was shot down, and then T-I-K-E-E, then T-Y-K-I. A lot of different versions until they finally found a bill that was that they could compromise on, and that was T-Y-K-E-E.
Hmm. Why Taiki?
I have no clue.
It's really cool.
I mean, there's not that many. I know that I'm not the only, but there definitely wasn't that many in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like in North Philadelphia.
Right.
Well, now I can understand my older brother because that's his name.
Right.
And then Marquise is a pretty common name. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know exactly. You know, I'm glad that they fought about it and then came up with that because it's a unique name. And even though I have the initials TJ, no one ever calls me that. Hmm. Yeah, so it's very strange for me. Hmm. Did I make sure? No, never mind. I knew it.
Do you need to take a call?
No.
Okay.
I thought I set off the alarm, but I only put it on snooze. Ah. And I was like, oh, that's going to interfere with me in a couple minutes. Yeah, and now it's off. Just making sure.
So, in Wisconsin, you were there till you were about 12 or so.
Yeah. I would say closer to 14, 13.
Okay. So
because I didn't finish middle school. Oh. The last day I had in Wisconsin, I was acting up in my English class. I don't know exactly. Oh, I was acting up because it was my last day.
Because you could, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think her name was Miss Kulik. She was like, you know what, Taiki? You're staying after class tomorrow. And everybody in the classroom started laughing because they knew it was my last day, but she didn't. And so I was just like, I will happily see you tomorrow at 4 o'clock. You know, like, I will happily see you then. And, you know, I'll never, I would serve the detention if she ever contacted me because
she's still there.
Yeah.
<waiting.
laughs> I would still serve the detention if she ever contacted me, but that was my last day there. Mm. Not the best impression, but I had a lot of great memories.
Yeah.
I think Gerstad is when I first started dancing. We had a new principal.
Is that important? Is that a big part of your life?
Yeah, because from then on, that's one of the few things I've been able to carry with me everywhere I lived. Hmm. Because I don't remember that a whole lot from Philadelphia. I was very young. I don't have a lot to take with me from California because we left so abruptly. But from Wisconsin, I lived there for 9 years. You know, so for me, that was like, you know, when you're young, especially, that's like a huge majority of your life. You know, I can remember more, obviously, and I can make more of my own decisions. Some of those decisions weren't the best, but that's part of growing up.
Do you mind me asking about what things come to mind?
I probably got suspended for fighting. You know, I probably did something stupid with one of my brothers, breaking stuff. But I learned very quickly that I should not do bad things because the consequence of doing that bad thing far outweighs. Like, just don't. I just hate getting whooped. It was just like the worst thing. I was like, man, this is bad. I don't want to end up like this. You know, because I don't like it. You know, like I don't like the whole lead up to it, like pick out a belt. You know, I don't like that part. I don't like the after part. I don't like any part of it. Like my friends can hear me outside screaming. Like it's the worst. Like I'm gonna do the best I can to stay away from this kind of trouble.
Did you and your brothers get up into some trouble together?
Mostly them. I started separating from them because of my interests and because of, you know, I would always seek differences. Or it's like, okay, this is all the same. That's predictable. But, you know, you're not from here. Where are you from? You know, and seeing where I can make connections that are unique. I found out about that. I know, one of the girlfriends I've had when I lived there, her name was Karina. She spoke Spanish, and for me, that was like, what? You speak in a completely different language. Can you speak Spanish to me all the time? She did it until we broke up. But, you know, it was still a good relationship. I'd take her out if she called. You know, if she called me, Miss Peculic and Karina, if they ever need anything, I'm in Wisconsin. I'll come through.
Were you sad when you had to leave Wisconsin?
Very. But I kind of got used to it, because even in Wisconsin, I moved around a lot. Or not a lot, but, you know, I moved around a few times, different neighborhoods, small stints, though. And for me, I became really good at meeting new people, because for me, everybody was new, and everybody had a unique thing, and I was like, that's so unique. I want to, you know, get to know you. I want to connect with you. Should you accept me? You know, middle school is a hard time for anybody to find friends.
That's the truth. You mentioned a buddy named Xavier.
Oh yeah, he actually introduced me to football. Yeah, he introduced me to Michael Vick. At the time, he was good. He showed me this cover of Michael Vick, like half football gear, and then like the other half, I think he's in regular clothes. And he was like, "You should be like him. You're left-handed, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, I am, but I throw right-handed, so like close enough." And you know, that's really when I started. I was like, "Man, if I could play football, I would." Little be known, I later moved to Texas, where I did play football.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. I was going to say, football's a pretty big scene in Wisconsin for the Packers.
That's country. But we were like far away from Green Bay.
Yeah.
I think the most north I went was Milwaukee.
Okay.
Yeah, and even at a young age, I understood beer and cheese and brats were, like, that was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, my view of alcohol at the time wasn't, like, negative. It was just, like, I knew that there were mothers against drunk driving. I knew that existed. But I also knew that alcohol was just like, it's social. You just drink, you're around your friends, you're at the Brewers game, you're at the Green Bay game, and you just drink a little bit.
The Brewers game even, right?
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Vassell, I think my third grade teacher, split us into different groups because, you know, it's easier to manage a class. And my group was called the Brewers for some reason. I never understood that until I got older and I was like, oh, brewery.
Yeah.
And then Milwaukee, like the baseball team. Like, I just never understood it.
Yeah. So the experiences up to that point seemed to be in smaller communities. Did you ever take trips to the big city? Like, Chicago is nearby. It's a huge city.
The closest we came to Chicago was Glendale, I think, in Illinois, to ride some horses.
Hmm.
Like, and that was about
not,
the
not
closest.
A city experience.
No, not as you would imagine. But there are horses in Philly. If I wanted to combine the two. But no, I never could say that I lived in a big city at that point. I would say that, you know, I was like in the isolated suburb, then moved up to like a small town. When I moved to Texas, I first moved to Canyon. And Canyon is basically a village.
Where is that? Like West Texas? North?
Yeah,
south?
It's west, northwest Texas.
Okay.
It's 45 minutes south of Amarillo.
Okay.
And Amarillo is the only, like, within, like, outside of that, then you're talking, like, maybe an hour and a half to Lubbock, 3 hours, 4 hours to, not Los Angeles, but, oh, man, I forgot the name of that. It's going to come to me.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Well, what brought your mom to Canyon, Texas in 2009?
She graduated from college on Mother's Day.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was. We danced to the Boyz II Men Mama song, like the song for Mama. That was really special.
Yeah.
I'll always remember that. And
she is a Philly girl, isn't she?
Yeah, right, like that. And in Wisconsin, the graduation ceremony was in Kenosha, because she went to UW Parkside.
Cool.
And, you know, so when we moved to Texas, it was, I believe it was based on the reason of, like, well, you know, I want a new life. I love my sister, but I want to, she's also, I think Yeah, I think she moved to Texas first.
Your aunt did?
Yeah. Oh. I think she moved to Canyon, Texas first. And then we did. Yeah, I believe that's what happened. She moved there first and was just like, actually, it's pretty nice down here. It's a really good change of scene. And, you know, my mom was having, you know, outside of college, she was just like, well, I'm just raising my kids. And every now and then, you know, the dad would come back into our lives. And I kind of don't want that anymore. You know, I don't like that. I don't like the chaos. And the neighborhood wasn't always great because people would get evicted if they had a bad relationship with the property manager. And she did a lot of nonprofit work, even though technically she didn't work at a nonprofit. You know, we would hold baking classes for the community. I would be like her little teaching assistant.
At your home, this is in Racine?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is, because like Shelbourne Court was basically a bunch of apartments all surrounding, you know, a single office that was the landlord's office, but also it had a community room. And in that community room, we would do stuff like bake cakes or... That's most of what I remember, because I remember that was delicious. I don't know if we've ever did anything educational, but I remember that we did a lot of things that were based off of, like, home ec. And that was a lot of fun.
That's cool. And then other families come participate. And just kind of...
And, like, other kids younger than me would participate, and I'd be like, okay, well, let me help you, because I'm older than you. You know? And
cool.
My mom said I'm in charge, so... You know? And then, like, that's how that's going to work.
So from Racine, you're aunt moves down to Canyon, Texas, and your mom moves her family down there too.
Yeah, I think like maybe a year after or something like that.
All right, and she did art history as her undergrad.
Art was her undergrad. I just always emphasize art history because that's what I've seen her do.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what I see her continue to look into.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of the books that we have in the house, if they're not sketches or sketchbooks, they're art history books.
Huh.
You know, things that like it literally explain. Well, this kind of brushstroke explains all this. And I'm like, wow. Like, I'm sure it does. You know, like, I'll take your word for it.
Were you also into art? Or you or your brothers? Were you guys doing art projects at home?
Nah.
Like, really?
Actually, you know what? My oldest brother, Kyle, he had a hand. He could sketch a little bit. And then I started playing piano then. And I started dancing then. So, like, I had that art.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Tell me about dancing. What was, like, was this just dancing with buddies, like, playing on some music? Were you taking classes somewhere?
I was. I was taking, so we had a new principal, Dr. Centrone. He came in, and, you know, I think one of his first or second days, he was like, during lunch, does anybody want to learn how to dance Latin dances? I'll teach you salsa, I'll teach you bachata, I'll teach you merengue. Just 45 minutes after school, you know, don't worry, you can call your parents and let them know, you know, whatever the deal is, or... If you need a bus, maybe we can organize the bus to make another loop. I raised my hand, and then my ex-girlfriend also raised her hand. So I tried to put my hand down, but then he saw me, and I was also a little bit of a troublemaker. So he was like, "Oh, Taiki, no, I see you. I see you tonight." And I I'll either see you after school or to detention. And I'm like, "Well, you got me beat." So like, no matter what, I'm gonna learn. And then like some fifth graders raised their hands, or wait, I was in sixth grade, so like seventh or eighth graders raised their hands, and I was like, "Oh man. This is serious." Like, we got 7th and 8th graders here. They're basically grown.
And this is the principal who was creating this program.
Yeah, and then after school, like, just like you said, I started learning the basics. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, a little bit of bachata, and a little bit of merengue. And I think the salsa that we did was cumbia, because what I remember wearing was, like, a, you know, straw hat, and there were, like, things on the ground, and... If I saw a picture of it, I'd remember, but I just remember, I believe it was cumbia. The style of salsa was cumbia. He could have been Mexican, so that would make the most sense. Like, if his ethnicity or the nationality was Mexican, he would naturally go to cumbia, but I don't necessarily remember.
What role did dancing play in your life for you?
Well, it was like my thing. It was like, okay, my family life, my school life, but then there's dancing. And like, that's just me and whoever I'm dancing with. But I wasn't that good, so, like, it wasn't something that I developed. Also, I wasn't asking people to dance often, so it wasn't something that would come up. When I was in Texas, I took a Spanish class, and I was part of the Spanish club by taking the class, and they wanted to have a dance team. I was on the football team at the time, and I was like, dancing is cool, and it's a way to not only be well-rounded, but I'll be better on my feet.
Excuse me, thank you.
I'll be better on my feet, because dancing, you know, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. I was on
the
cumbia.
So you did football and did the dance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was nice. It was a good time. We did cumbia, and we did cumbia all around the region. We won all these nice awards, and we were a pretty good team.
Like, tell me about who's we. Who's this team that you're on?
It was my dance partner. Her name was Cody. There was also Trevor Scholes. So cool. He was the lead with Patricia, who made up all the choreography.
How did you find these folks? Like, was this something that was advertised at school? How did you transfer your dance experience from Wisconsin to also finding it in Texas?
Well, it was the availability. Somebody just once said, "Hey, there's a dance team. There's a Spanish dance team. Is anyone interested in joining?" And like in the coolest way possible, I said yes, of course. You know, I was like, maybe, you know, or something. I leaned back in my chair, you know, because I was also a football player. So there was like a little bit, and I was also on the debate team in FFA. So like I had a bit of clout, you know, at the time.
What's FFA?
Future Farmers of America.
Oh, right on.
So at the time, I learned everything you could ever learn about a cow, how to cut it, where the steak comes from, everything. And actually, lately, I've been relearning it because now that I eat a lot of steak, or I have the ability to, I like to know where my meat comes from.
Huh.
And I like to know how it's cut. I was even considering going to a butcher, but, you know, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. Like, was Canyon an agricultural community?
I'm sorry. When I first moved to Texas, I did live in Canyon. And when I was in Canyon, I finished middle school at Canyon Junior High.
Mm.
And that's when I started playing football. I wanted to be a quarterback, but they wanted me to be a receiver because I was a tall, fast, black guy. And Canyon, like I'll talk about in Amarillo, hasn't seen a black quarterback in a very long time. So they're not trying to.
Mm.
And that was my first, like, interaction with, I'm different, and that's a bad thing.
In Canyon?
Yes.
So, like, an experience of prejudice there.
Yeah. And I was just like, and then, you know, talking to the other black people, we would be like, yeah, I know, it kind of sucks. And I'm like, but why are we tolerating this?
Yeah.
Like, I will burn this whole place to the ground. Not really, but I didn't have any power either, but I was just like, this is a huge issue for me. I remember one time the principal took me aside and was just like, you might find school difficult here, not because of the teachers, because they love you and they support you, or not because of some of your friends, because they also love you and support you too, but because you're, and then I was old enough to, I was like, because I'm black, and he was like, yeah.
Wow.
And I was like, cool, man. And, you know, different things would happen, like, this girl lied and said that me and my Mexican friend Alex, and, you know, he and I were very much on the same page of, I don't like tolerating the small comments or the prejudice from all these folk. So, you know, we try not to beat people up. That was our thing. Like, if you don't fight, I don't fight. And then that was our pact. There was one time this girl said to the bus driver that Alex and I were saying all these really rude things to her. We weren't saying rude things to her. We were just saying rude things to each other. She was just hearing us. And so we got suspended. And living in Canyon, Texas, our house was, I think, 20 miles. You know, it wasn't 20 miles, maybe not. But it was a long ways away from the school. And my mom had to work every day. And his mom had to work every day. So that small, they said that. There was no, like, you know, judicial system. There was no review. It was like, you two are suspended for 2 weeks. Walk. Or, you know, get a ride or don't go to school. And it was like, wow, it's that easy. It's that easy. Huh. There were times that people would give me and my brothers racial slurs. And if we raise a fist, we are suspended twice as long as them.
Wow.
We would talk to the parents. The parents would be like, it's not a big deal. They're just kids. And my mom would be like, this is actually damaging to them. Not just to their reputation, but to how they perceive themselves as different in this community.
Yeah, what impact did that experience have for you then? I mean, what were you internalizing then?
I was in between a few things. One was questioning, well, why can't you just love people for just who they are, not for what they look like? And then another thing was, people should know me for what I do, not who I am. And if I do well, I don't have to worry about being personal. So I wanted to do well in football. I wanted to do well in dancing. I wanted to do well in anything I put my hands on. When we left, when I finished middle school, and we went to, then we moved to Amarillo.
Was part of that, the hostilities that your family was experiencing there, was that part of the reason to get out of Canyon and to go to move to Amarillo?
Very possibly. Very possible. I mean, Amarillo was also a better city. And I don't know if we had a house, but it was around the time of the bubble, the housing bubble thing. Mm-hmm. I never asked questions about it, but we used to live in a house, then we moved back to an apartment. Mm-hmm. And when we moved to Amarillo, and then that's when I went to high school at Tascosa.
Okay.
Played football there, was on the dance team, the Spanish club, FFA, debate. I think that was the bulk of it.
So, you were learning Spanish throughout this whole time?
Oh, yeah. I see. because I was a football player, I got a few privileges, which would be nice.
What do you mean? What do you have in mind?
So, you have to take Spanish 1 and Spanish 2 in order to graduate from high school. I thought I was going to graduate from high school in Texas. In Texas, I didn't. I graduated from high school here.
Here in Philly.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was the second semester. Either way, the math didn't add up that I could take Spanish 1 and Spanish 2 comfortably to have an easy senior year. So they created a Spanish 1.5, where they would give me the credits of Spanish 1 and 2, but the work of... I mean, I'm telling you, the work, I did nothing in that class. I mean, we did a few things every now and then. Our teacher was incredible. He fundamentally changed what I once separated from language and culture to connecting them. Hmm. And so I really did appreciate that. But I could do anything in that class. Nobody cared. Hmm. You know, like, as long as I wasn't like beating up anybody or like deliberately ripping tests up, I was okay.
Tell me about debate team.
Debate team was important because that's where I found my voice. I started high school in 2009, and 2009 was a good year for a few reasons.
Why? Tell me.
The day after my birthday, 2009, this guy, I don't know if you heard of him, January 22nd, was sworn in as president.
That's a pretty 44th big day.
President of the United States. The world stopped. You know, everybody was watching the TV. I remember I was in Miss, I forgot her name, I feel so bad. I also had a crush on her. I forgot the name of her, but we were in her class to start off the day, and everybody, the lights were off, every classroom was watching the TV.
Yeah,
watching him getting sworn in, listening to his speech. And then after the speech, everyone was just like, wow, this is okay. But it was still Republican country, so some of the kids were like, nah, everything he said was a lie, he's a great speaker, but everything he said was a lie.
Huh.
I'm like, whatever, I don't, like, I'm too young to argue about this with you. I'm on the debate team, I know what I'm talking about.
So tell me about the debate team then. So 2009, clearly an important year.
Oh, yeah, that was just to say that the debate team and the alignment of that event made a lot of people put me in the Obama era at that school because in some ways I guess I sound like him, or he sounds like me. And when I would wear a suit, the resemblance would, I guess, be easy for people to make if they've only seen 6 black people in their lives. So it wasn't one that I would argue, but one that I would, you know, take with some grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
But the debate team is really where I figured out, I'm like, well, speaking is a skill, and I could be good at it. I took Lincoln Douglas debate really seriously. I took extemporaneous speech, and there was another one that involved me. It was like extemporaneous. And then there was another one that was me just coming up with stuff off the top of my head. And I was really good at that at the time. And also I did prose, where I just read poetry. Or I read like a few lines and I would perform it and have some fun with it. So that was really where I practiced my speaking skills. And that's where I really started to connect. My brain thinks this. I know that I can say it this way, but in order for it to have a certain effect that my brain wants, I have to say it this way. And that's when I really started seeing myself code switch. I talk differently around black people than I do white people. I realize I talk differently around my mom than I do my friends. That's obvious. But I realized that that was a skill. And then, you know, I could use that methods of persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of started that avenue of like policy, you know, looking at what people argue. Not exactly what they're arguing, but like, or what they argue, I should say, but how they do it. Like, what is your methods of persuasion for this, you know, purpose?
Mm-hmm.
I became really interested in that. So I see the, you know, I watch a lot of Obama speeches, and I would, you know, I kind of reflect on that and be like, man, that's pretty convincing. But it's convincing in a way that I'm comfortable with, a way that I feel familiar with. And that's something that I've, in some ways, adopted. Like that method of thinking of cause and effect, of always trying to illustrate the relationship of this and an effect. Mm-hmm. Cause, effect. And then just, you know. Mm-hmm. And also encouraging people to have more well-informed opinions whenever I disagree with them. Because I found out that you can disagree with me without being stupid. You know, I can disagree with you without being stupid. Like, there's no prerequisite for stupidity, mm-hmm. nor is there one for disagreement. Mm-hmm. And I honored those kind of things. And so I'd love debate. I see different things that we could debate on, like, should immunizations be compulsory? You know, should we get rid of standardized tests? Well, those are the kind of questions that I would like to debate with people. And then, like, sometimes it wouldn't be interesting because, you know, they were just like, no. I'm like, why? Because tests are stupid. I'm like, well, that doesn't give me a lot to work with, man.
Yeah.
That was one of the annoying things.
An avenue for that inquisitiveness.
Yeah. It was still there. It was just taking different forms.
And in the meantime, you're also doing dance and traveling. It sounded like you were traveling with this team.
Yeah, I was traveling with the team, competing at different places, and we had so much fun. You know, we would meet so many people, and like to see Mexican people, Mexican families look at us dance and be like, yes, like that makes me feel like home, or that's something that I can do. I want to do that with you guys. Like that really warmed my heart. And also all the food, because we would get so much free food traveling, and everyone just loved us dancing. I mean, I never seen us dance. I've just seen people watch us dance, and they just enjoyed it. So I don't know if we were really good or they were just really supportive, but it was just a lovely experience throughout.
And then also football, too.
Oh, yeah, football. I didn't have a lot of play time in football. I was developing, you know, quarterback. The last black quarterback for the varsity team was 1982. And, you know, you can see the wall of all the quarterbacks and their face shots, and there's just that one black guy. And I'm like, you know, and I'm thinking I'm going to graduate from that school, and I'm like, that's going to be me in 2012. Mm. 2012, Tyke James. I didn't, you know, obviously I moved, so I couldn't do it.
Was that vision of being the first black quarterback in quite a long time related to also having our first African-American president, black president?
Yeah, because I was just like, well, if he can be president, that's a milestone. And that's a milestone that can be achieved knowing that it starts from a certain point. Mm. And that has to start somewhere. And so I was just like, I'm not going to wait for someone else to be the first black. I can be the first black if I really try, if I really show up, and if I can dedicate myself to this, if I can have focus on that. Mm. No, I didn't get it, but it was still something that I reflect on.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I almost got that, but there's always going to be situations that I can push myself towards a milestone or help push other people. Mm. Because I was also on the track team. The track team was mostly black athletes. And so we kind of felt like we ran that sport. Like, that was our sport. So we had so much fun with it. And we would always kind of think about football. Like, it's kind of different. Like, how the coaches would treat us during football season versus track season. Track season, we're superstars. Track season, you know, they take us out to eat. Track season, they buy us things. I mean, the lines of legality are there, but nobody did anything bad. Versus football season, I understand that there's a bigger pool of people. Football season was just, like, a little different. For good or for worse, we recognized it.
What kind of things were you interested in the classes you were taking? I mean, you talk about debate and mm-hmm. interest in prose and...
Oh, yeah, all that was... None of those were classes. All those were, you know, extracurriculars. I was very interested in all my classes. I loved asking questions, even if I was wrong, just so I could learn. I had a great math teacher, Mr. Gordino. Everybody loved him. I learned a lot about geometry. But I think the class that I'm mostly going to take away from Texas was Black History, taught by a Native American man, Mr. Porter. He was so literal and sensible and, like, direct. And he was also very conscious, which, you know, was like, oh my gosh, okay. Like, this was the world before I understood not just people being racist and prejudiced towards me, but understanding it as a system of oppression against a people for the purpose of white supremacy. Like, to understand that walking out of that class was one of the most valuable things that I got from Texas.
How did that influence your interactions with your friends, with family? I mean, what kind of conversations was this inspiring?
I don't think it did as much as it helped support my growth. Because my growth was, telling from how it was prior, it was based on finding unique connections. Finding, even in those unique connections, similarities. Finding, like, seeing that diversity and celebrating anything that can unite us. Because, you didn't ask to be born that color. You didn't ask to be born identifying with that gender. You didn't ask to be born liking the same sex. But what about you can you love and that I can appreciate about you? Because I can't like you if you don't like yourself. And so I would always find things in people to like. So my friends group were always the ranging from the super popular kids to the like the weird people that pick their noses. I'm like, everyone has something unique. And like there's a connection that I have and I could walk around that school and everybody would say hi to me. Because I would say hi to them. I would just want to get to know them. I'd see people sitting by themselves or people wearing the same colored shirt as me. And I'd be like, hey, we should, we're in a conversation now. What are you going to do? And also all the extracurriculars, I would meet people that, I was the only person on the debate team on the football team. But there was also someone on the debate team that was on, softball. Or maybe there was also someone on the debate team that, traveled the world. Was a military brat like me. No one would say I was much of a brat. I only moved one place. But still, and it would just be interesting to be like, we're all here for this purpose, debate. We're doing different events maybe, or we have different interests. But we're all here for that. And it's interesting how we all came here. And, I would explore that through relationship building. And for me, that was interesting.
You watched your mom go through college as a young man, as a little boy. Was college something that you knew you wanted to do? Or is that something that was really kind of... In high school, I'm wondering, what was your vision for the next step of your life?
In high school, I was a little immature. So I was thinking, I'm going to go straight to college, play football, D1. I'm going to go to University of Texas. I'm going to be the next Vince Young.
That's the Texas culture down
there,
right?
Yeah, like, so I was definitely bred through me. And I was like, and I might study a little bit in case, I get injured. Like, that was the only thing stopping me in my mind, getting injured. Mm-hmm. Not that I wasn't good enough, because I was definitely far from adequate. To the Vince Young level that I thought I was going to be at. It wasn't until I moved to Philadelphia that I was like, wait, I need to think about a future.
So tell me about this move to Philly then. So you moved in your senior year?
Yeah, it was definitely, it sucked.
That sounds like it was wrenching.
Yeah, because nobody, I mean, my mom told me in November of my junior year. So like when football season was ending, we're moving back to Philadelphia. And I was like, but...
But I'm going to be a senior next
year.
Yeah,
but like everything that I've done is my legacy. And my legacy ends in 2012 in Texas. We're moving back to Philadelphia.
So when did y'all move that summer?
We moved the following summer. So after junior year, it was a lot of goodbyes, but I did not service a single one. I probably said goodbye to 3 people.
Why?
I didn't know how to say goodbye. I was like, I built all this stuff. I can't complete it. I can't answer any more questions. I have to walk away. So I just left. I mean, a lot of people learned that I left Texas from hearing that I was in the hospital when I came back to Philadelphia.
What?
When I came back to Philadelphia, the air was so bad, so humid, so not what I was used to, it re-triggered my asthma. I had asthma when I was a little kid that I never knew about.
Huh.
Because I grew out of it. I lived in California, clean air. I lived in Wisconsin, clean air. I lived in Texas, clean air. Came back to Philly, it was humid. As soon as I got off the plane, smelled cigarette smoke, and I coughed. And that first cough was like, ooh, I don't do that. That doesn't normally happen. And right before that, it was in May, 2 weeks prior, I was participating in a regional track meet of the 400-meter dash and the 400-meter relay. Those are hard races.
Yeah.
You had to sprint the whole lap. And so I'm thinking, I don't know how. I was like, I must be out of shape. I started breathing heavy, like breathing seriously heavy. Walking up a single flight of steps, I would just be like, oh man, I'm tired. I'm going to sit this out. I'm just going to sit down for a while. And then I would continue to breathe heavy, seeing my chest just go in and out. And I'm like, what is this? This is just strange. I'm going to ignore it. I still went out for runs. I just played basketball with my cousins. And my speech was even affected, where I wasn't able to complete a sentence because I would constantly breathe in and out. It was about 2 weeks of that, that I think it was like a Thursday night or something like that. I wanted to make sure my mom didn't have to work because I realized how important that was. We're not moving to Philadelphia for me, you know, or we didn't leave Texas and then like, I'm punished. It's not about me. It's about what she can do to provide for the family and how I cannot be an obstacle to that.
And you knew that then?
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, 17.
What year was that y'all moved back to Philly?
2011. Yeah.
And it was for your mom's work? Opportunities for your mom?
Yeah. And opportunities for me because she said, you're going to go to Temple University. And of course I rolled my eyes. I'm like, they don't even play football there, you know? And they do play football. They had a pretty good year when I came there.
Pretty good.
So like it was like, all right, you got me on this one. You got me on this one. And I realized I didn't, you know, football was no longer my passion because there were other things. But
so your mom moved to Philly for what kind of work? What was she doing?
I think the first job she had was at the Salvation Army.
Huh.
Like, she's been in the nonprofit world for as long as I can remember. So for me, nonprofit and government work is the only thing that I know.
Mm.
My brothers have, you know, worked in private industry places, but I never have, and neither has she. And that's just something that I've followed.
Hmm. So that's a big move. It's a big move from Texas to Philly.
Then I'm now in a city. I'm in a huge city.
Huge city.
And I'm in a city where more people know my name than not because a lot of my family lives there. So everyone's like, "Hey, Tyke," and I'm like, Hi. I don't know who you are. I don't remember you. But they're telling me that you're my auntie, so hello.
Ah. So your mom's family was still all in Philly?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And my dad's family.
Okay.
So, like, everyone was in Philly.
What role is your dad having in your life around this time? Is he kind of in
a... I haven't spoken with him in a long time.
But, I mean, when you all moved back to Philly.
Yeah. Even then, it was still, like, a long period before I heard from him. I mean, I heard that he tried to get in contact with me when he heard that I was in the hospital.
Mm.
Because, I mean, everyone, this is what a lot of people knew. I moved from Texas to Philly, now I'm in the hospital.
Wow.
And so they're just like, what happened?
So I'm sorry, I've been steering you away from that.
No, that's fine. What happened with that?
So it was a Thursday night,
and I believe my mom didn't have work the next day, and that's why I think it made sense to do it. I kept coughing instead of going to sleep. I was like, if I'm coughing while I'm on my back and I'm trying to sleep, there's either fluid in my lungs or I'm suffocating. One of the two means I should stand up. And I saw my mom outside, you know, she was just talking, and I was just like, Mom, I can't breathe. She was like, okay, drink a cup of coffee. I don't know why. But she said, drink a cup of coffee. And I think I do know why, because it increased my heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
Drink a cup of coffee, sit on the couch, let's see what happens for the next 6 hours. So, you know, I didn't sleep that night. It's like 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock, or 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning. Everyone starts waking up. And I was like, yeah, I'm not any better. She was like, okay, well, let's go to the hospital. And I was like, and when she said that, I could see that something shattered in her mind. She was like, oh my God, I took him from Texas, where he loved, where he had everything, where he had his legacy. And now he's in Philly, and now I'm telling him, yes, we have to take you to the hospital. So from taking you out of what you loved, I am now taking you to the hospital. I could tell that a glass shattered.
Mm.
But I was like, oh, so I have to be the calm one. Immediately. So, you know, instead of calling 911, we didn't have healthcare, can't afford it. So we asked somebody to give us a ride, and I was being silly. I was like, oh, please come in first. You know, and I'm like, but you're the guy that's dying. I'm like, well, it's debatable. And on our way there, the guy was smoking a cigarette in the car. And I was like, this is fine. He was like, it's my car. I was like, that's a good point. It's my lungs. But, you know, go ahead, buddy. He eventually, you know, opened up his window a little bit. He didn't want to let the AC out.
Wow.
Yeah, it was bittersweet. We got to the hospital. You know, what's going on? He's having trouble breathing. Does he have a history of asthma? I say no. She says yes. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I was an athlete for, you know, 3 years. And those 3 years, I developed a lot. Because, you know, when you're a teenager, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I was much bigger then. And, you know, I could run all these laps. I was unstoppable. In fact, they even called me Tykeezy because I made working out look easy. They're like, he does all that work. He makes it look so easy. Tykeezy. Like, so I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, that's impossible. I didn't have asthma. It didn't exist. I did all this work. My brother has asthma. You know, he has an inhaler. I don't. She listened to my lungs. She was like, ooh. How long has this been going on? I was like, 2 weeks. She was like, yeah, you got to get to the thing. So, you know, immediately we get nurses coming in. You know, they did a very terrible job at the IV thing. I had 5 tries here, 2 tries here, 3 or 4 here, 2 more here, and then they eventually got one there. And I was like, it's not that hard. I don't know what you're doing, but I don't feel like it's that hard. But I was in the room, you know, cracking jokes with the nurses while they're like, I could see that they were moving urgently. The doctor comes in and says, Tyke, I think you should stop talking. And I'm like, I think, you know, blah, blah, blah. She's like, no, I think you should stop laughing too. You could have had, at any point, even right now, a cardiac arrest. And I was like, what's a cardiac arrest? I gave her the facial expression, I stopped talking. She was like, your muscle is a heart. Or, your heart is a muscle. And you're familiar with muscles. You know, you look like it. When your muscles are tired, what happens? They give out. If your heart gives out, you have 2 minutes. Luckily, you're in the hospital now. But at any time in those 2 weeks, the way your heart rate, how high your heart rate was for those 2 weeks, you could have collapsed. And then that would have been it.
Wow.
And I was just like, you know, like, geez, I came back to Philly, my home. Even though this is my home, I left my entire life in Wisconsin and Texas and California. I left all that just to come back here and die. This sucks. You know, I was like, this is a little less than ideal for me.
What was triggering this? Was it where you lived in Philly? Was it just the air quality in general?
It was the air quality.
Where did you all move to in North Philly? Where'd you move back to?
When we moved back, to West Philly.
Oh, West Philly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We lived in Mantua at the bottom, off of 36 in Aspen.
Okay.
With my auntie. With another auntie. Different auntie. And it was so strange. And I was just like, the home, like this place that I call my home, almost killed me. Because the air is not an enemy you can see or touch. It just gives and takes away.
So what was the next step with you with that experience?
Everybody was scared. So, you know, after I got out of the ER, you know, they had me on watch for like 24 hours. I couldn't eat anything. And they gave me this drug that kept my heart rate and lungs going because they were just like, we can't just stop it. If we just stop it, that's bad. That's what they explained. It's just bad for some reason. So I was like, fine. You know. I mean, I had no room to debate either. When they got me into like regular, I can kind of chill. I had the oxygen mask on. And for me, it was just still so strange. I took a picture of myself in my mom's home that I later deleted. And it was a picture that I never thought I would see. Like in the hospital, like, you know, gowned up with the things and the mask and like distressed. I was like, I've never seen myself at this point of weakness. You know, I've lost fights. I've been hit on the football field plenty of times. But never did I see myself so like weak in a place that I should be so strong. And you know, my little cousins would see me and they would just be like, we've never met, but you know, I'm your big cousin that might die because he came back to Philly and the air is so bad. And so like a lot of people, you know, visited me in the short span that I was there. So I was really only there for like 48 hours, maybe 72. And when I left, no one wanted me to move. They were just like, Tyke, you can't run, don't do anything athletic. And I was just like, what is going on? Like, that was the only thing that I had. I can't dance, I have no friends, I don't know where the library is. Like, I can't do anything here. So, yeah, I was pretty depressed, you know, going into high school.
Yeah.
Because that was the beginning of my summer. That's how my summer started. So the rest of the summer was me calling schools and telling me, despite my high GPA and despite my good standardized test scores, they do not accept seniors. Central, Northeast, Boys Latin. I can't remember all the schools, but I remember those were the first three that I wanted to reach out to. Those were the first three that I liked. And I was like, okay, so now I'm going to schools that I don't like, schools that I wouldn't prefer. schools that people are telling me don't go to. And those schools even said no.
So what did you end up doing?
I went to Motivation High School eventually. Someone found a way to get me to go there. I had to take a special meeting with the principal. Wow. The principal had to like me. And so I didn't feel like I was myself at all. I felt like I lost everything when I came back.
How did that change what your plans were for after high school?
I was just thinking, I'm going to be happy when I'm at Temple. I didn't visit campus
once. So Temple was still part of the vision.
Temple was 100% part of the vision. Hmm. It just wasn't... I didn't know how soon that would be achievable. Hmm. And I remember the school, you know, it's a predominantly black school that has a super large focus on getting to college. Like, they pride themselves on the people that they get into college.
And Motivation.
Mm. And it was a graduating class of 55.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you got to know people.
They got to know me.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, when I first came there, I was not in the best of moods. I was not the charismatic type that was inquisitive, that loved debate or anything like that. I was angry because I was like, everything that's here is part of something that was taken from me. Mm. Like, this will not be able to replace the happiness or the delight that I had in being successful or even in failure that I had when I lived in Texas or Wisconsin. Mm. So I'm here at this school and the content seems remedial to me. Like, I was like, this is not challenging at all. Mm. You guys are looking at these issues as if they're big, and they are not. Mm. And so I was just like, I hate this. I had to wear a uniform. I didn't like that. In high school, I always wore the color red. Everyone knew that. Every single day, I wore the color red. And here, they were just like, no, you have to wear a white shirt and khakis. And I was like, excuse me. You know, like, I didn't... It was really hard for me.
Philly was a shock.
Huge. Huge. And, you know, despite even being the new guy, and, like, the girl's like, oh, my God, the new guy's cute. He's from Texas. He might have an accent. I wouldn't talk. I would just sit there and be angry in class. At times, I would open up. Like when the professor or when the teacher asked, so after the 9/11 attacks, what was the congressional response? No one had an answer. And that was like the Patriot Act. It passed unanimously. And then they were just like, he talked. He knows things. He's angry, but he talked. You know, and there would be small stints like that where I would find it to be entertaining for me to share or to be more open.
Tell me about why Temple was still part of the vision if it's in Philly. And Philly is kind of this different sort of emotional space for you. Mm. Why stay?
Well, everywhere I moved, there were things that I didn't like about it. So I had to adapt. Mm. And I took this in the same way. Came here to Philly, almost killed me, but I'm going to learn to adapt. Mm. I'm going to learn that my past shouldn't define my future. I'm going to learn that I can selectively have parts of my past that help guide my growth, but it doesn't necessarily have to be my future.
So tell me, take me from, because I want to transition to the second part where we're going to get to the visioning soon, but take me from the time from that final year, senior year in Philly, surviving, up to the present. So what's the trajectory been for you from then to today?
I knew that I was going to go to Temple. I didn't know what I was going to do there. I didn't know that there was going to be so much to do there, because when I got there, I did a whole lot. I started with as a business administration management major, but before I even took a class, I changed it because I realized I couldn't answer that question. I changed it to math, computer science, and teaching.
Interesting. So, why that?
Not enough black teachers. Not enough black male math teachers. And I had the skills to speak. And outside of understanding math, I can also inspire people by telling stories with numbers and telling stories with functions and equations in ways that not only could they grasp, but play around with. And I think that my style of teaching would have been, you know, something that people would have admired and something that would have helped change some lives.
You say would have been.
I stopped being a math teacher and I went into strategic communication with a focus in rhetoric and public advocacy.
When did you make that transition?
When I got a job at the state office. So that's about in August.
Okay.
Yeah, so right around September 1st.
This past August?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So are you also still taking classes at Temple now?
Yeah, because I changed my major and I had to be there a little longer.
Yeah.
I thought the major was going to be a little more relevant and it would make more sense. But I didn't... The reason why I didn't initially take that major, and I looked at it, you know, before I had the math, I looked at that because I was like, this is perfect for me. This is me. But I was like, I didn't come to college because I feel like I'm an expert in something. I want to further that expertise. I came to college because I want to learn. And my best opportunity to learn will be in math and computer science and, you know, with teaching. Because not only do I know nothing about computer science, I can get a lot better at math. And I do want to teach. So that combination of things was what I was very passionate about until I changed it. I mean, I'm still passionate about it. It's just not a passion that I'm working towards right now.
Yeah. I also understand you did some environmental education work.
Yeah.
Right. How did that start?
Out of high school, like my senior year in high school, one of the opportunities that I found was at the Copps Creek Environmental Center doing public education as a subcontractor with the water department.
How did that, I mean, you were just kind of at the library and...
No, I was in my environmental science class, and this guy Tony walks in, and he's like, "Who wants to watch birds and learn and get paid?" And I was like, "Learn while you earn? Okay." And I was like, "Wait, I'm actually really interested in this. You know, like, this is answering so many questions. That bird is different from that bird, and it's different from that bird. That bird came from Nova Scotia, and this one came from Brazil, but they're both here. This is so interesting. This bird can mock other birds, but it's a blue jay. Not a mockingbird, as you would assume. This bird, you know, looks like this, but the female version looks completely different."
Had you ever done any kind of that sort of study before of birds and, like, ornithology sort of stuff? Was that ever something you were interested in?
One time, I almost picked up a dead bird, you know, and that was frowned upon, to say the least. But that, you know, I would say that was my closest.
So was that work you did, like, after school? Was that in the summer after you graduated from high school?
It was weekends, mostly. Huh. And the weekends would mostly consist of us going to the environmental center. Our leader, Tony or Dan, who's also a manager, giving us some type of lesson, and then we would take a hike. We would look at things. We would identify plants. We would learn about the history of Copps Creek, the natural history that included the people and, you know, the environment and the connectivity of the both. And, like, that was a very enriching experience.
In what way?
I never connected people to the environment. I just thought the environment grew and people grew separately. Or people, being people, would get rid of the environment. And there was nothing that the environment could do. But I realized that there was a very strong connection between the two. In Copps Creek, at least, I know that that story included crime. I know that that story included drug use and gangs. Even the murder of a police officer. And now, you know, the future has brought some change. You know, I was part of that brought, you know, hey, at Copps Creek Environmental Education Center, it's a public, like, you should see environmental education as a community service. Because learning about the environment is appreciating your community. You guys, you know, are right off the block from the park. There isn't any reason that you shouldn't know the difference between a sycamore and an ash tree. There isn't any difference that there isn't any reason that you shouldn't know what a blue jay is or how a cardinal sounds when it's chirping versus a chipmunk. You know, like, I mean, I'm a little too passionate about it sometimes, but I think some people should know some things just because it's right outside their doors. And I love encouraging that engagement, encouraging ecological interpretation for your own good, like knowing for your own good how to put things in your own words when it came down to the environment. Because it's not the environment, you know, Sierra Club, North Face, something that, like, white people do when they go to Colorado or in the mountains somewhere. It's like, no, it's down the street. Like, it's in West Philly. It's in Copps Creek. It's part of your history, part of your parents' history. It's part of the history of the city. And I think that if you're going to ever consider yourself a proud Philadelphian, you have to consider yourself a steward for the environment. And that includes the city, and that includes the natural history of it, the green and the gray.
So Philly is where you had your kind of environmental awakening.
Very much so.
You came to the city to find nature.
And that's what's incredible, because everywhere else I had a lot more access to it and a lot more, the less appreciation. And I think part of that comes from me just knowing that this is my hometown. And Philadelphia has a lot of green spaces, and the diversity of those green spaces really is interesting. I know that I've had time to really enjoy Copps Creek, Wissahickon, and now East Fairmount Park. I hope to enjoy a lot more of Philly. As you know, as me living here, I'm learning more about environmental leaders, because it, for me, it started with environmental education, very basically. And then from environmental education as a curriculum, you'll see principles of environmental justice. And those principles of environmental justice kind of help grow my passion in the field, so to speak. And, you know, that passion gives me opportunities to grow some skills that lead the way for environmental jobs, like working with Audubon and going to events with Penn Future and Penn Environment. And then, you know, understanding my place in advocating, understanding my place in educating, and understanding my place in sometimes agitating, to quote Jeremy, when necessary, for causes that would include having the air quality so that there's not another kid that comes from Texas, that comes from a clean air state, that comes here, almost dies because they can't breathe the air. If I could do a little bit of work advocating or educating or agitating to make sure that doesn't happen again, I'd be happy. That would be ideal.
What kind of social networking opportunities was the environmental education world? What did that open up for you?
Well, a lot. I mean, the first thing I realized was not a lot of black people do it. So every room I would walk into, it'd be like, a young black man about the environment? He's so well-spoken. That well-spokenness led me a very long way, because from debate in Texas, that's where I really learned how to speak and articulate. And now it's like I'm here and I'm like, people would say something to me and I'd be like, there's a better way to say that. There's a more persuasive way to say that. There's a more profound way to say that. And how you understand it won't be a way that people that look like me will grasp it. So your understanding is a disconnect. No matter how passionate you are about this, the way you're explaining this thing that you're very passionate about, unfortunately, will be like your judgment and your intent will seem different to someone. So like that disconnect, you'll lose the trust, you'll lose that connection, and it's unfortunate. But I can champion this cause. I can understand it my way, and I can work this and in some ways be an ambassador to this idea, this new idea that we should protect the environment, because solutions in environmental justice are some of the same solutions in social justice and economic justice. And people just need that first step to realize it. And I think that first step sometimes is just environmental education, teaching them about birds, teaching them about stormwater management, teaching them about the natural history of their own neighborhood.
When did the justice component become something that you were able to grab onto? I mean, it was the experience with the birds at Cobbs Creek and understanding some of the natural cycles in that area. But when was the justice piece added to that, to your understanding?
We would learn things, and sometimes we'd be like, well, that's pollution. You know, these things pollute. This is what a pollutant is. This is a greenhouse gas. This is this and this that. And I'm like, well, why do we have it? Why are they there? Why are we learning about this? Why aren't we learning about, well, yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah, we found a solution to that. Or everybody recycles, you know, things like that. Like, why in environmental education are we learning about the bad things that we're doing to it? Like, how are we going to be stewards if part of what we're learning is basically anti-stewardship like things? And like, well, because that's just the way it is. And I'm like, well, that shouldn't be. There should be some method against this. Like, there should be some justice. And, you know, I started to watch some documentaries, and former Vice President Gore would come up every now and then. I'm like, who is that guy? And I learned that, you know, he's one of the highest positions that led the fight on climate change, that led the fight on environmental issues. But I understood environmental justice from that big picture. I understood it as it disproportionately affecting people who don't have the ability to be like Al Gore, who don't have the money to live in a better place, who don't have the voice to say, don't put that in my neighborhood. Environmental justice meant advocating for those people and finding solutions for those people. Those people mostly being poor, people of color, immigrants. Finding ways to help them first, because, you know, it's not often that people want to help the people that need the most help for whatever reason, especially when it comes down to environmental issues and need. We've seen, I think right after 45 was elected, the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's going through predominantly poor neighborhoods and cities, predominantly people of color, native people. And it's like, wow, that would make perfect amount of sense for someone who has no agreement with the idea of environmental justice. That, oh yeah, it makes sense because like the rich people don't want that in their neighborhood and they pay more taxes or they fund my campaign or they vote or, you know, they look nicer or I identify with them. So let me bring you these poor people who will move anyway because, you know, their houses are worth not that much. Their rent is only so much. They can afford to move or whatever their idea is. That lack of justice, that lack of principle on that idea of justice is, I've been finding to be prevalent in positions of power. So environmental justice really grew in me as I seen people in power either on my side or against my side, not talking about it. So I'm like, for everything that's good with Gore, I don't see him as the leader for environmental justice. I don't see him as the leader for the people in Chester County. I don't see him as the leader for people that, you know, turn on their sink and fly, you know, fire. He is absolutely against that. I know that he is. But he's not the leader for that.
Tell me about how you came involved in politics, because you work with Representative Bullock.
I work with the state representative right now. She's amazing in a lot of ways. She also serves on the Environmental and Energy Committee in the House.
And this is Representative Donna Bullock.
Yes, sir. She's amazing. I ran for class president my freshman year in high school, and that also helped the cause for people calling me Obama. And, you know, even on Facebook, they'll still call me that to this day. I never had an interest in politics because I always thought I think I got this quote from Parks and Rec, politics is about winning and government is about service. If I can get a job in government, like being a teacher or being someone who can educate, like an educator, that's what I would want. I saw a teacher as someone who was in the classroom all the time, and that's good. I mean, as a math teacher, I would expect to be in the math or in the classroom all the time with the whiteboard or something like that. But the idea was I was still serving. And if I'm not serving people, I'm not passionate about it. Like, I had an offer to be a manager, to take a class to be a manager at Walmart, the one in South Philly. I met one of the top CEO people or whatever. And, you know, he was really impressed with how I presented myself, with my resume and what I wanted to do in life. And he was like, you should be a manager. And for me, I took that as a bit of an insult. I'm like, I want to serve people. And you want me to work at a place that doesn't pay people a decent wage. You want me to work at a place that doesn't respect, on reputation, their employees. You know, and you think that I'm after this paycheck. Because he gave me a number of like, oh, this is how much you make through the training, and after the training you'll make this much more. I was like, I don't care about that. If I'm making enough money to serve people, that's all I need. If I'm making so much money that I start serving myself, it's gonna create disharmony in the purpose that I'm serving. So, you know, keep your six-figure whatever up your nose. I'll be cool at my $30,000 a year job because I'm working for the people and I'm serving the people. And these are the people of my neighborhood, people of my color, people of my history. Not all of them are my color, but it's people regardless that are disproportionately affected by bad things. I'm, you know, in that same pool.
This seems like a good place for us to take a little break before we transition into our future visioning. Does that sound good
for
you?
Yeah, most definitely.
Great. All right, so part two of our continued discussions here. Transitioning into thinking about the future here and energy in Philadelphia. And so because energy is kind of an abstract thing and the future is definitely an abstract thing, I'll start off with a few abstract questions.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you value most, that you love?
Diversity. Unity within that diversity, or even without it. I also value justice. I also, you know, I value answers to questions, solutions to problems, and rights from wrongs. I value puns and alliteration. On an unrelated note, but something I still very much appreciate.
Yeah.
And I also appreciate art, whether it's motionless or, you know, it requires motion. So that's dancing, that's sound, you know, through the piano. I like the things that can sometimes help me bring about a new world. Like, dancing was a new world for me. Playing the piano is a new world. And it's a different world than politics, than, you know, environmental justice talks, and different from, you know, wearing bird socks. I like all those different things and coming together in some way or fashion. Fashion, literally. And then, you know, just appreciating it. Like, appreciating the ability to appreciate all these different things that individually are good by themselves.
Great. So, yeah. What are some of the things that you that scare you, that you fear?
Well, I'm always scared whenever there's not a lifeguard around and I'm at a pool, because I do not know how to swim. So whenever I see that, I'm like, oh man, this could be it. I always think about the headlines. Black man dies in pool because he doesn't know how to swim. It's just like, oh, so embarrassing. So many better ways. I'm also scared of being put in situations where no justice can be made. So that could be something as in the air as an interaction with the police officer, where I know my story is different from your story and you can be acquitted and I will be a hashtag. Sometimes those situations are me and, you know, a big group of people, where if something were to happen, it doesn't matter who I am in that. Your, you know, mission, if it's malicious, you wouldn't discriminate so far on the harm that you're trying to cause. I know that I also fear... You ever seen that movie, Purge?
Mm-mm.
It's this idea that this political group called the Founding Fathers created this new law every whatever day that is. Maybe it's April 12th, 24 hours, you can commit any crime. All crimes, you know, you can do whatever. You can kill people, basically, and that's what people do. I'm scared of that in three different ways. One, that someone would think that that's a good idea. Two, that it continued to be an idea that people were like, okay, let's, you know, come back next year, let's do this again. And then three, because it disproportionately affects poor people who can't afford to defend themselves, which is really a metaphor for environmental hazards, which is really a metaphor for social hazards and you know, other economic barriers. I see that movie and I'm like, people really think this way. This could happen, or this is happening, just in a smaller form, not in a so dramatic form where crime is legal for 24 hours one day out of the year. But, you know, in the fictional world of The Purge, part of the fear that I have is seeing people have the rhetoric of, well, crime is at 0%. No one commits a crime. All the crime is committed on The Purge. Poverty has gone down. No poor people around. I don't see homeless people. That's pretty nice. Nobody's walking around hungry. Everybody who has money buys food. It's just like, wow. That you know, that movie really, it scared me in a very, like, you know, profound sense, in that, like, people think like that.
Hmm.
I'm not being disproportionately affected. And the consequences are actually benefits. So, you know, if that oil, you know, if that pipe goes through this poor community, my energy bill goes down and there's more jobs. And it's just like, wow, that movie illustrated that to an extreme, but it illustrated that in a way that I reflected on with a lot of fear.
Hmm.
And, like, you know, there's not a moment in that movie that I can't look at, because it's not actually a scary movie. It's just the idea of the movie itself was just, it's frightening.
What are some of the things you would work to protect or even fight for? Or what are the things that you do fight for?
I fight for history in some ways. In that, I want to remind people that as humans, we are good at taking care of the environment. And so we lose our humanity. We lose the definition, the historical definition of humanity, when we're doing things against the environment. I want, and I have been fighting to tell people that racism is a huge systemic oppressive force that doesn't necessarily exist with a store owner saying a racial slur or a store owner giving you an extra eye when you walk in. Like, it doesn't just exist in those forms. It exists in housing, it exists in healthcare access, it exists in educational access. Exists in, you know, the professional world where you want to develop, whether there's a glass ceiling based on your gender or a closed door based on your skin color. Excuse me. Fighting against that is really hard, but it requires a lot of social and rhetorical tools, and those tools are the tools I'm trying to build. Those tools are the tools I'm trying to share with other people, because I can't fight every battle, and there will be a time where I'm done fighting. And so I want to make sure that while I'm fighting that, I'm also, you know, giving out clues, giving out hints, giving out the idea that people should fight with me.
What are some of the things that make you most hopeful?
Bad things. As ironic as it sounds, when Trump was elected, I was like, okay, so really anything can happen. A black guy was before this guy. And if you ask anybody in 2000, even 2006, they wouldn't believe you. They would laugh in your face. A black guy, and then this other guy. So, if something bad can happen, I think something good can happen. I just think on the basic principle of math, if it can be negative, it can be positive. There is an absolute value to this action, to this event, to this occurrence, to this phenomenon, and I think it should be positive. You know, so whenever something bad happens, I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, you got that win. You can celebrate that here. And obviously this is more political wins and losses and not like tragic losses of natural disasters or things that, you know, include a huge financial loss that you can't recover from. But, you know, part of the game, and we talked about this earlier, is winning and losing in politics. But that's some of the reason why I like it, because it gets you away from the service. But I do get hopeful in seeing some of the more solemn things, because I think that there's that can either serve as a reminder of what we fight for and what we will continue to fight for, or it's really something to work opposite against, you know, to be like, well, this is now what I'm fighting for. This is it. This is okay. Let's go. You know.
Another abstract question: when you hear the word energy, what comes to mind? What do you think of when you hear energy?
Turning on the lights and the lights turning on. When I hear energy, I also think about light. So like, there's like the practical level of energy means I have the privilege to, at any point in time, walk into any room of my house, and then the light will turn on. But it also, like, I immediately also go towards, is energy a wave or a particle? Maybe both. Probably both. I think it's both. So, it's, you know, my science and physics and mathematic mind never leaves me. I mean, if you look at my desk in the state office, you'll see that I've written out kinematic equations. One of the interns asked me what a derivative is, because I was like, this word derives from this word. And then, yeah, I was like, you know, not derived in the sense of math, like derivative. And then they're like, wait, what's derivative? So I went tangent from that point to explain what a derivative is. And it's like, see, it's not about change. It's about the rate of change. And that's what's important. Just like the difference between velocity and acceleration. I had this whole lesson. And I still keep the piece of paper just to remind me. It's like, you can still do that. Like, you know, I can turn my Bill Nye on.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Well, let's move into the future visioning portion here. And the first step forward for visioning is to think about 50 years in the future. So that's going to be the year 2067.
I'm glad you did the math.
So 50 years in the future, 2067. Just as a reference point, thinking back 50 years in the past from today was the year 1967. So America was a very different place. Movie tickets cost $1.25.
We couldn't go to the same movie theater.
That's, yeah.
probably not.
In some places, it certainly was discouraged, continued.
Yeah, discouraged, to say the least.
Yes. Yeah, it was a very, very powerful time. America's fighting in Vietnam. The Black Power movement is emerging and developing a different kind of consciousness. And the feminism is really kind of starting to take off. The environmental movement is beginning to emerge. So that was 50 years ago. So I want us to think about 50 years in the future. Mm-hmm. What changes will happen in Philadelphia in the year 2067? What does Philly look like and feel like, and what sort of energy role is played?
Well, more people are smoking pot, but in a good way. But 50 years ago, pot was the enemy, public enemy number one. 50 years later, from here, pot will be as meaningless as a, you know, I can't even think of something that's so casual, meaningless, and cool. You know, I really can't. Maybe being on your, no. There's hazards to everything, but, you know, smoking pot is just one of the things that don't have that same hazard in any circumstance. You can do the stupidest thing, but then that's just you being stupid. Mm. That's not marijuana doing that for you, you know? So
in 2067,
more people like, at any time, like, oh, do you want a glass of water and some pot? I would love some. Yes. Which strands do you have? You know, like, that would be the regular whatever for the people that do, because not everyone has to. It's fine. 50 years from now, we'll still be able to turn on the light switches. Whether that's by our phones or by our minds, but we'll still have the privilege of access to turning on things, having energy, having the ability to, I want to be in this room to turn on this light, to turn on the TV, to watch this. I feel like that connection still won't be lost. The privilege, because when those things don't happen, like, it's not, I don't think a lot of people can think of a time that they walk into a room and the light switch didn't turn on, or they tried to turn the TV and it didn't work.
Where's the power coming from to make those lights go on in 2067?
That's a good question.
In Philly.
I would imagine Pico either got smarter or got defeated, and they're finding better ways to get electricity to our houses.
What does better mean? What do you mean by that?
They don't need physical infrastructure. If there was a way that electricity, energy, and information can travel in a wave, then we don't need power lines. If there was a way that we could have energy be in one place, like an electron being in one place, and then appearing in the same electron, same information in another, a lot of that energy infrastructure is broken down. I know that scientists have already made a way for an electron to teleport in one place to another. They just copy the information, send that information, and then it appears. Hopefully that becomes more abstract in the sense of energy.
Like,
we can literally send that to some type of energy core from Pico to your house. You pay your bill, they make sure that energy, that information, that of that energy, that electricity, goes to your home to power it. You keep paying your bill.
Do you think that'll happen in 50 years? There'll be wireless electrical?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How are people moving around in Philly? How are they getting places?
I still think walking will be a popular choice. You can't change the fact that we're, you know, Philadelphia is a pretty walkable city. I think what you might find is a different emphasis on public transportation and cars. There's going to be a different emphasis on cars in that they might be seen as, okay, I need a car if I'm going to go to Chester County. I'm going to need a car if I'm going to go up to Croydon. I'm going to need a car if I'm going, like, all the way over there that public transportation can't help me. But if you're not walking, taking a bike, or whatever a bike will be in 50 years, or public transportation to where you're going, then, you know, you probably don't have that many places to be, and that's okay. So as far as traveling, I would imagine, on a practical sense, it's just more convenient. You know, it's either that everyone's using Lyft or Lyft-like services, so the need for a car for you is not necessary, and Lyft or will be that public utility in some way where, not that, you know, the government has to take it over, but where the government will subsidize it in some way, where everyone has access to that service of car to, or door-to-door service of travel.
How are the cars powered? Are they running on gasoline still?
Few. The old ones, the classic cars. In 50 years, those cars, oh, that's a classic. You got a Ford Mustang? Woo! Like, classic. If they're not powered by hydrogen or solar, then I mean, maybe it's something that I don't know yet. Mm. Because I can see a compromise in 50 years of, let's say, the city of Philadelphia looking at Lyft saying, hey, we're going to pay your employees more. We are going to ensure that you never fail as a business. If you work with this other company like Tesla, so that all of your drivers drive cars that are better for the environment using this type of energy, using either solar or using, you know, like, you know, electricity, like electric cars, whatever it is. And then Lyft will agree, Tesla will agree, and City of Philadelphia will agree. And it's just like, you'll use the Lyft, and like that car that you're getting into, zero emissions. The car that you're getting into is going to go somewhere cleanly and nice, luxury, hopefully.
With turning on those lights so cars, hydrogen or solar, electrically charged cars, with turning on the lights, do fossil fuels still have a role to play in 50 years?
I think fossil fuels will have a smaller role to play. Whether we deplete our resources in fossil fuels and we have to go figure out the secrets of the federal government, because the federal government has reserves of oil that can last us a little while. But if we ever get to those secret reserves, then we're not in a great place. And if we start fighting over resources, then we're looking at a completely different country. Hmm. So hopefully the compromises that will be made sooner rather than later will be compromises to increase access to resources, not start a war. Because, like, you know, there's compromises you can make to fight, and there's compromises you can make to not fight. And hopefully we go for the latter. And the compromises that I hypothetically made between City of Philadelphia, Lyft, and Tesla. Because you don't want them fighting for... Because if people start fighting for oil, people start fighting for energy, we're not doing too good. Because that's where we see other countries fighting for those resources, fighting for some of those fundamental resources, take away rights. Mm. If I don't have the right to, you know, clean food because my refrigerator can't keep my food cold, clean water because, you know, there's no infrastructure for me to get it, I'm going to fight for it. So we have to fight for these things, you know, on that higher, not higher level, so to speak. But we got to fight for things on a level where we know, where we're fighting back and forth and it doesn't include fists. Before we get to the level where we're fighting over water. Because we're fighting over water, we're going to use fists, we're going to use knives, we're not going to play by new rules but our own.
So let's take another step forward and think about what is Philadelphia like in the year 2140. That's almost 125 years. It's 123 years into the future, the year 2140. Climate scientists anticipate some major changes. For Philly, much wetter, much hotter. Some of the areas east of I-95, down around Eastwick, those neighborhoods could very well be flooded because of the tidal rivers that Philadelphia is based on. But broader than that, beyond the Philadelphia region, there's expectations that some of the climatic changes could lead to some of the sort of fighting that you're talking about. Yeah. Right? There's governments that could be collapsing, waves of refugees, extinctions that are happening, possible collapse of agriculture. These are all things that could happen in the future. But what is your vision for Philadelphia in the year 2140, in about 123 years from now?
I think it starts with the trees we plant today, metaphorically and physically, will be the solutions of tomorrow. The trees we plant today will give us oxygen in the air. More oxygen in the air means a different atmosphere, a better atmosphere than what we have now.
So more trees in Philly's future.
More trees, more herbaceous and woody plants, just to cover both sides of that. And that will help in two ways. One, it will help absorb water. I know that when you think about stormwater management, instead of buying bigger pipes, you just buy plants that can absorb water. Some of those investments that we're making to grow plants obviously take time. A lot of time will pass, and we will see Philadelphia will look greener. I think Philadelphia's future is very green. And not only is that going to be good to protect people from water, but it will be good because it will also help the air. Trees are filters, and so are, you know, plants are filters in a lot of great ways. So what we plant today will be what we breathe and live in tomorrow. That's one. When it comes down to the idea of agriculture completely falling, to be honest, I've never seen that as a realistic option. Mm-hmm. Because we solved world hunger. We're just not going to do anything about it because it's a lot of work. We solved world hunger when we created the 3D printer. We solved world hunger when we started messing around with genetics in our foods and modifying them. Because if I don't have to grow anything, but I can have a ripe tomato at any time, I'm going to go for that. Especially if it's cheap. Especially if it can be created on demand. And I would imagine we would live in a future that we don't need miles and miles of crops to be irrigated and watered and, you know, pooped on just to have some food for the country or food that we can give to other countries.
So 3D printers and genetic engineering will create the food for us.
Yeah.
So there's really no need for agriculture in the same scale that we do today.
Yeah, I think agriculture will look different. Agriculture will look more like white lab coats, you know, and formulas, and not so much nice overalls and a tractor.
What does that look like in Philadelphia then? I mean, what is the city like? Are there more people here? Are there less people? Or are the buildings looking different in 100?
Well, after we get our fifth Comcast tower, I think the population of Philly will definitely increase. I don't know if we'll change the city limits in that wake, but I know things are going to get taller and bigger, more dense. I know that the pluralistic demographic of Philadelphia will be minority, majority. What we call minority now will be strange to call majority of Latinos. I'm expecting that at that point in time, if you know one language, you're part of a minority. And so, you know, it's going to be to every advantage of yours to not only be culturally competent, but to have an air of inclusivity of you, whether that's socially or professionally, because you won't be successful or lead an enjoyable life at that time, if I had to guess.
What's the energy system like in Philadelphia in the year 2140?
I think that the teleportation of electrons has gotten better at that point, that it's instantaneous. I can put energy there, I can put energy there. We can use the sun for energy. That's always going to be there. We can use wind turbines as necessary. And I can even see smaller communities having power grids. It's just like, well, yeah, that neighborhood has its own power grid right there. They're good.
So community-come-village style, community grids, local microgrids.
Yeah,
precisely. Throughout the city.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that will exist with the issue of income inequality. Because income inequality doesn't get better with population. So I'd imagine income inequality will still be a huge issue. We can all have access to the same things, but that access, the quality of those things can be dramatically different. And that will, you know, that can very much be based on your income. And I don't know if there will ever be a timely solution, from when we would fight with swords and horses to when we get up to the level of spaceships, if a poor person and a rich person can live the same life with quality.
How are people moving around in Philadelphia in the year 2140?
I still hope they're walking. I'm a big fan of walking. I think that will, as bipedal humanoids, we will keep our feet going. I think that travel will be more elevated, because right now most of the time that we travel, it's one-dimensional. We travel on the ground, so I think travel will include elevations, different levels. It'd be hard to, but we've never divided the city in, you know, tiers of travel.
Like, in terms of verticality.
Yeah, like everyone travels on the ground. Nobody flies to get from Center City to North Philly. So for that to change, that would be interesting. And I think that's something that Philadelphia at the time would be open to.
So take me from there to almost 300 years from now. This is going to be the year 2312. We're talking 295 years into the future, the year 2312. As a reference point to think about what that was almost 300 years ago in the past from today was around the early 1720s. So in the 1720s, North America was dominated by Native American communities and nations. There were strong inroads of colonization that are happening in different parts of North America. Philadelphia had already been founded as a city. It is about 40 years old at that point.
Nice.
but the American Revolution wouldn't happen for another half century.
Yeah.
The major energy sources in the 1720s by far is wood as the dominant energy source, but also food and plants that people or animals would eat, and then you'd use the animal muscle to get things done. And then also wind and water were some of the also uses of energy. Coal really wouldn't overtake the United States for another 150 years, and then oil after that. So that was 300 years from today. What about 300 years into the future, in the year 2312? Is Philadelphia still here?
I think so. Really, one of the oldest cities, one of the identity of America, and I hope that the Constitution will still stand. Even with amendments, I think that Philadelphia will look, sound, and taste completely different, and that we will no longer use or have the need for natural resources. Wood, oil, plastic made from oil, mined iron, ore, coal, any product, like none of those products will exist. So a lot of, like, we might have fake wood for the aesthetic because maybe humanity still just likes the aesthetic of wood. Fine, whatever. Hopefully we get better taste in 300 years. But not only, I mean, I think it will either be based off of lack of interest or lack of resource, that natural resources will no longer be part of anybody's lives. Any building, any infrastructure, any project won't have wood or dirt or rock or anything like that.
What will it be instead?
I think that if we can teleport to the idea of electrons, if we can teleport electrons back and forth 125 or, you know, even 50 years from now, from today, and then 125 know how to do it on a level that we can provide energy to an entire city, I think that we'll get to a point in scientific advancements that we can dictate what atoms do. Now, matter cannot be created or destroyed, but we can change information. We can make our own steel. We can make a new material that isn't steel, that isn't, you know, titanium, that isn't something that we would recognize today, but has the strengths of what we know is something that is strong, has the weaknesses of nothing, like... I think in 300 years, all the food that we eat would just be a benefit to our bodies and there would be no consequence. It's like, man, I love this cheeseburger, but it goes straight to my thighs. Not anymore. You just love that cheeseburger now. Love it up. But I think we would also be responsible in knowing that, like, our taste need to be smart. Because now that we don't have consequences of, you know, of eating bad food or having poor health, we have to be smart in what we identify with as our food. I think that there will be a huge identity infrastructure, and not one that's based off of like what I have and don't have, but it's just like, what am I going to be if I eat cheeseburgers all the time? I know that it won't affect my health, but who will that turn me into? Am I a different person? Really profound philosophical social ills would be that, because the issue would be, well, that person eats cheeseburgers, don't talk to them. They think differently than we do. We eat carrots. It's like, what are the carrot people got against the cheeseburger people? You can put carrots on cheeseburgers. I've seen it happen.
So cultural identity will be much greater issue rather than desire for resources, because it sounds like there would be total abundance.
Yes, and that we can create our own resources. I think that we'll figure out a way. I mean, again, we can't create matter, but we can change information. If we can change information to be what we want it to be, we can do whatever we want.
Where's energy? How does energy play into this future, this abundant future?
I think energy will take the role of almost an endowment in the way that either capitalism can control it or the government will guide it. And that's, here's 10,000 years of energy. If you all leave your lights on in this city for 5 years, you will deplete it. If everyone in the city, you know, turns every light on in their house, turns the dishwasher on, turns the TV, turns everything on, your endowment of 10,000 years of energy will turn into 5. How will you use this energy?
So it'll be totally socially derived as far as how as choices.
Yeah.
But and there will only were, be so much.
Yeah. If it were to be in 300 years that it's guided by capitalism or controlled by government, that then communities, cities, neighborhoods, from the small power grids to the bigger power grids for cities, are now left with endowments of energy, so to speak, where we can harness the energy of a proton splitting apart for your entire city, and that for your entire city will give you 10,000 years, let's just say, 10,000 years of energy from splitting a proton. Use it wisely.
Is there any so there is a limit to it, and that limit is controlled either by capitalism or the government?
Yeah, like the government would be like, we'll reissue you another 10,000 years, or capitalism will say you have to pay for another 10,000 years. But either way, the social conscious of the environment, the social conscious of conserving energy will be one that everyone feels collectively. Because it's, hey, if you leave that light on, the entire city runs out of energy in 5 years instead of 5,000. Hmm. And everyone will feel that. Because it's just like, your light being on means no lights are on. Or, you know, like, we all have to be part of this effort. Because it's literally all of us or none of us. All
right, so stronger unity in that future. How are people moving around in 300 years in Philly?
I really hope they're walking.
I love it.
I have less hope that they're walking at this point because they're not walking to transport themselves. They're probably walking for leisure, which I will accept. But to get from point A to point B, just like the electron, you can just, your information can exist here. Your information and consciousness will come back here.
So people exist as information and consciousness in this future.
Yes.
And they can move that at any speed or any way they want.
Precisely. And, you know, that's why identity will be a bigger thing, because they're thinking, yes, I know that I'm information, but I still have this human tendency to be unique, to want to identify myself not as the numbers on the board, but as the face in the mirror. And whatever that means to me, eating cheeseburgers or carrots, walking places instead of teleporting, I want to be who I am, and I want to find that genuinely. Hmm. So,
is there anything else that you want to add about your visions of the future?
I hope the Eagles win a Super Bowl. Hopefully not in 50 years or 125 or 300, however long it takes. I just hope it happens. I hope the first black president isn't our last. I hope that when the population of the majority becomes the minority or becomes a pluralistic majority, everyone can kind of see we have differences that we can celebrate. We have differences that we can appreciate, and these differences are the things that will help us grow in the future, because there's a lot out there that we don't know. And our flashlight is getting bigger. Our flashlight in this dark room is getting bigger. But that flashlight, it can get as bright or as big as it wants. We're only learning how dark the room is. We have yet to enlighten it.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Yes, of course.